is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
We have to get our guys to love it. And I don't think just playing games is enough. And I don't think just skill training is enough. And I'm unhappy to tell you that I think everyone's doing it wrong. And that is, they're focused so much on the skill development and not the game development. And so my curriculum, for example, is based on game development, of which skill development is a part of it. And if I could wave a magic wand and go back and do it again, I would have raised money and built a business on game development. I never would have called it skill development, because the idea is to help advance their game, not their skill alone.
Coach David Thorpe has been coaching, teaching, and inspiring players from all levels of basketball for over 3 decades. Thorpe started his coaching career at the high school level at Dixie Hollins High School in St. Petersburg, Florida. In 1993, he left team coaching by opening the first specialized player development program in the country, producing high-level major college prospects by 1994. It spawned a global business where now in every city in the basketball-playing world, there are families working with private coaches. 6 years later, Thorpe moved from helping high school and college players to NBA players and professionals playing overseas. Coach Thorpe has helped his players earn salaries amounting to over $1 billion in the last 19 years, and the list of players he has worked with closely have been NBA All-Stars, World Champions, European League Champions, Asian Champions, and Olympians representing 6 different countries. He is both skills and life coach to many of them, as he is to some successful head coaches and executives in the NBA and Europe. Coach Thorpe served as a lead NBA analyst for ESPN.com for 10 years, stepping away to pursue more consulting and speaking opportunities in the business and sports communities, then partnering to create TrueHoop.com with respected journalist Henry Abbott. He can still be heard weekly on many of the top NBA podcasts and radio programs, such as The Low Post, NBA Radio on Sirius XM, and The Full 48, along with True Hoop's Bring It In 3 times a week. Coach Thorpe published his first book, Basketball is Jazz, Stories and Lessons from a Basketball Lifer, in February of 2017. Fall in love with basketball again this February with our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market. Be sure to check out their new Dr. Dish facility model with advanced analytics. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is Nick Legalvo, head boys basketball coach at Lane Tech High School in Chicago, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
If you're looking to improve your coaching, please consider joining the Hoopheads mentorship program. We believe that having a mentor is the best way to maximize your potential and become a transformational coach. By matching you up with one of our experienced mentors, you'll develop a one-on-one relationship that will help your coaching, your team, your program, and your mindset. The Hoopheads Mentorship Program delivers mentoring services to basketball coaches at all levels through our team of experienced head coaches. Find out more at hoopheadspod.com or shoot me an email directly, mike@hoopheadspod.com. Follow us on social media at hoopheadspod on Twitter and Instagram, and be sure to check out the Hoopheads Podcast Network for more great basketball content. Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. FastDraw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off FastDraw and Fast Scout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improved communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its play bank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball. You will definitely want to take some notes as you listen to this episode with Coach David Thorpe from TrueHoop.com. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads Podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here without my co-host Jason Sunkel this afternoon. But I am pleased to be joined by Coach David Thorpe from True Hoop. David, welcome to the Hoopheads Pod.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Excited to have you on. Want to dive into all the things that you've been able to do in the game of basketball. And then at the very end, we'll jump into some current NBA stuff. Let's start by going back in time to when you were a kid. Tell us a little bit about your first experiences with the game of basketball. What made you fall in love with it?
Yeah, I started playing in 1974. I was 9 years old, and my family had moved to Seminole, Florida, which is a suburb of St. Pete, St. Pete, Clearwater area. And I played for the Junior Warhawks Association, and apparently I was pretty good. And I don't remember a whole lot, but by the time I was 13, I was making the kind of all-star team stuff that we had for people that age, even though I was really small. And then I started playing in high school. Our high school was right next door to where the league was, and played 3 years of high school, my last 3 years there. And then in college at Florida, the guy I played for in high school was an excellent general fundamental coach. Bobby Knight was like his idol. I think they were friends. So we were all Indiana Hoosier fans. And when the movie Hoosiers came out, we recognized every drill. He was really not a good coach in terms of game management. He had no idea how to inspire anyone. I wrote a book you may know about in 2017. And in the 275 pages that I wrote and published, he was not any of it because he deserved nothing. But I definitely learned some toughness from that program and some basic fundamentals of man-to-man defense because that's all we ever played. And I liked it a lot then, but in reality, I wasn't going to be my profession. I graduated college. I could have been a manager for the Gators. A really close friend of mine was manager. By the time I was a senior, some people asked me maybe to try to walk on. I ended up growing and, you know, having some size at point guard and could shoot and pass, but I had no interest in it really. I didn't want to work that hard. I didn't know any better. And it's just dumb luck that I found this as a career because I graduated college, was going to go off to grad school or take a job as a writer covering football, actually. And I was offered a local coaching job, a high school JV assistant varsity job. And I said yes, just because I had nothing else to do. I was living in the beach that summer, just graduated Florida in 1987 from college and met a super hot blonde that summer at a place I took for summer employment. And she was just starting her sophomore year of college locally. And I thought, you know what, maybe I'll keep this coaching job and see if I can't get this girl to date me. So I ultimately got her to date me in October of 87, right when I started coaching. And we'll be married 32 years in August. So I chose wisely the girl.
Nice work. Nice work.
Yeah, I chose wisely with the girl. And once I started coaching, I realized pretty quickly, I like this. I think I can probably do okay with this. And that's how I got into it.
Who was the person that gave you that first opportunity?
His name is Mike McFerrin. He died a number of years ago. Mike was he had been the girls' coach at Seminole High School, where I was a student at. And he had coached before. In fact, I think 1 year he had what Sports Illustrated said was the tallest team in the country in high school, at Gulf High School in Newport Richey, Florida. But the school he took over at Dixie Hollins in St. Pete, which is now called Hollins High School, was very athletic and had produced some very good high major players. And but he had no idea how to coach man-to-man. So he, now coaching boys for the first time in years, had called my old high school coach and said, hey, I need someone that played for you so they can teach these athletes man-to-man. That my old high school coach called my dad. And my brothers were still playing at the high school. I was the oldest one and had been playing. And said, hey, what is David doing? I always thought he could be a coach. And there's a job open. So that's how it happened. So I talked to Coach McFerrin, who was not a very good X and O guy, but a fantastic person. And very quickly realized I probably knew a lot more about the game than he did. He could not have been a better mentor. He let me kind of run the varsity. And then as over the next 5 years, he got a little sick. We didn't know what it was. We thought it was just some back problems. within, I think, a decade, he had died of lung cancer, and that's what it was. But we didn't know it then. All we knew was I was able to kind of run practice. I totally was in charge of the defense. I the JV program was mine. I coached all the varsity guys every summer. I traveled the country working camps and everything. Really made it a point of doing that. And Mike let me do all of it. And I mentioned in my book, I mentioned two people at the beginning of the book in an honor. One was my wife and the other was Coach McFerrin, who had already passed at that point.
When you think back to that time, what was it about coaching right away that you loved, that you were like, man, this is what I got to do for the rest of my life?
There's a couple of things. So I remember, so it was probably, you know, November of 1987. We coached our first game. We had played a team that we had heard was really good, Northeast High School. The varsity was a top 10 of the state varsity. In fact, that year they lost in the Final Four. At the highest, we were in the highest classification, 4A back then in Florida. And our team beat theirs in overtime. And I remember being really calm during overtime. And as we walked off the court, I can still picture this in my head. I definitely thought, well, I really had no idea what I was good at anything. Apparently, I was a decent writer because I was offered a writing job at 22, which is pretty good. But I thought, you know, I probably could do this because I seem to manage my emotions pretty well. And then very quickly, I learned to love my players, really, really loved them. And so that probably was the initial thing. Over time, I started realizing, you know, we all have different brains. For my brain is nothing special in most cases, but basketball makes a lot of sense to me. I can see it and pretty much read it. Over the years, people joke that I kind of see the Matrix with it. I think it's just experience. And I also know how to inspire people, which is what we're in the business first and foremost, I think. As I wrote in my book, I think on page one, we are first in the business to inspire. So I'm pretty good at that. And I always have liked doing that. I've gotten better at it. I used to just yell and scream. And I thought that was the answer. And I don't mean negatively. I also yelled positively. But I've learned that I don't have to raise my voice to inspire people. And so those kind of things all coalesced into something that I thought I can do this.
What was something that you were not very good at when you started, and now you look back and you're like, man, I wasn't very good at that. But over time, you improved and got better.
I didn't have any kind of developed philosophy. It was more hodgepodge. So, for example, there was no way I was ever going to play zone my first 5 years as a coach, and because my high school coach didn't.
Right.
And even though I pressed and he didn't press, and we denied all passes ball side, and we didn't do that when I was in high school. It's a super silly – it's actually a very silly frame of mind to have if we're trying to win basketball games. And over the years, I developed a much more nuanced philosophy of player development / winning games. You know, there's a give and take to it that ultimately is nothing but a take. Because if you do a good job developing your players and maybe losing some early, well, later on in their careers, you're not going to be losing. You're going to be winning, and you're still developing. So – I'm happy to tell you that I definitely employed zone many times over the years as an older man. Mostly at this point, I'm coaching my son's AAU teams, and we built out, we had 36 different types of defense we could employ. And this was when they were in sixth grade with real easy calls. I developed this whole system. I still have it. I give it out all the time to people. And zones are a big part of it, or zone principles in some cases are a big part of it. And I didn't do that back then. I was just, I was more ideological and less pragmatic and scientific. And I got better at the art and the science of the game.
Where'd you go to learn the game? Because obviously as a young coach, I think a lot of us are guilty of this. You kind of do, as you said, what your high school coach did, or if you're a college player, you do what your college coach did. And I know my first coaching job, I was coaching JV basketball, and my entire philosophy was based off of the drills I did as a player when I was in high school, and the same thing as a college player. So where'd you go to develop yourself as a coach? Did you go to, obviously video was a lot harder to get back in those days. Certainly not the way we can get to it today, but just, was it mentors? Was it going to watch other practices? Was it reading? Where'd you go to learn the game?
I mean, this is one of the most important questions you could ask anyone. the very first thing I did when I got the job in St. Pete in 1987 was Coach McFerrin gave me a book called Dean Smith's Multiple Attacks for Winning Basketball, something like that. I have the book, and it's right behind me in my office here. And on page one of that book, page one, literally page one, Dean Smith wrote, this was, I think, written in the late 60s, that what he wants most in an offensive possession is to go to the free throw line. So he was analytical or adopting advanced analytics in the 60s.
Right. Yeah.
And so that really influenced me a lot. I have a library of videotapes in my office here next to my house. I have a library of books that are, you know, 60, 70 strong, pamphlets, workbooks. I definitely did all of that. I was very lucky too in that we were very good. I had great, great players, including a future pro, a longtime pro, and that played for us in high school for 4 years. And so because of that, I got to pick the brain of lots of college coaches because they were always recruiting our players. And I mean, Billy Donovan was a grad assistant at Kentucky for Rick Pitino. I worked Pitino's camp because he recruited one of my players when he was just at Kentucky. And Billy sent me a player development videotape of him and Herb Sendek and Tubby Smith doing player development stuff with guys like John Pelfrey and Dirk Feldhaus and Sean Woods, the guys that played in that famous Duke game.
Yep.
I don't know where it is. I'm sure it's in my office somewhere. I shouldn't be sure. I think it's likely here somewhere. I definitely copied a lot of what they were doing. As I said, I worked, I was one of the only men in America that worked both the BC camp, which is a Bill Cronauer, Bill Bolton camp.
Right.
And Five Star the same summer.
Rivals.
Yeah, but
rivals.
Because BC camp was Bill Cronauer of the C part of BC was from where I lived. In fact, I drove him 1 year to camp in Georgia. So he let me do it, and I did it a lot. And then Howard Garfinkel, you know, invited me to do the five-star camp, and I did a lot of those. In fact, later on, I ended up managing a lot of their overseas stuff. I was like brought in as a partner to expand their camps to I went to Turkey with them and Mexico. And so along the way, you meet with a million coaches. But because my players were so good, I pretty much quit drinking alcohol for about 20 years, mostly because in the off season, I would just want to pick coaches' brains. And when I would be at places like Five Star BC, and a lot of the coaches would enjoy drinking at night and used to get away from the kids all day, which is understandable. I just found a college coach and who was there recruiting players, and we X&O'd. One of my biggest mentors, actually, who I still just adore, is a guy named Gordon Gibbons, who was a great Division II coach where I lived, just retired recently from Division II, but he could have been a D1 coach. He chose to go the D2 route and had a great career at Florida Southern, and then he went to Clayton State. And Coach Gibbons and I spent, God, hundreds of hours talking basketball and X and O. And he recruited our players pretty hard. And for a while, he was the assistant coach to a guy named George Schultz, who at Florida Southern ended up becoming an NBA assistant coach with the Magic. And I spent a lot of time with him. Lon Kruger was a huge mentor. Probably Lon Kruger and a guy named Ron Stewart, who was an assistant to Lon at Florida. And Ron is now like director of G League scouting for the Bucks in Milwaukee. They were probably my two biggest mentors. In fact, a couple of weeks ago, my father passed away at almost 82. And one of the first texts I got, I don't know how we found out about it, but Coach Kruger sent me a text. So we've stayed in touch over the years, and they influenced my coaching enormously.
Those kind of relationships that you build obviously are really what the game ultimately is all about. It's such a small world when you think about the basketball space. Yeah. And when you go back to that time as a high school coach and you start thinking about how you're developing, and you mentioned that when you first started out, you didn't have a strong philosophy of, hey, this is the way we're going to do things. And you learn as you go along, obviously. So when you think back to that time and you talked about how important it was to build relationships with your kids, what did that look like for you as a young high school coach, building those relationships with your players in those early years as a high school coach?
Yeah, this is everything. For me, most of our players were from two different projects in St. Pete. And this was at a pretty rough time in St. Pete's history in the 80s. We had race riots prior to me getting there. And I had a player who lived in a dirt floor home. He's actually a great high school coach now. He was a great player for me named Larry Murphy, but he grew up as poor as you can get. I had another player named James Reddish who didn't have a phone or a car. And so if you had to change practice times, I had to call one of his teammates who had to run to James's house and tell him. James ended up being one of the top NFL prospects in the country out of University of Houston, and then was in a car accident. He was in the backseat and broke his back, and that ended his career. But he still got his degree and owns a trucking company. He's doing really well. I'm so in touch with all these guys. And so what I did is I invested time. I was dating this beautiful blonde I told you about, and then we married in 1990. And I started having players come over to do study hall, especially for exams at my house. The players that didn't have any place in their home to study because they had no furniture or it was just too messy, too many people, we would have them come over and study. I took a lot of pride in our kids doing well in school. Almost got fired, actually, because a teacher said I was racist because I was yelling at my black players for making C's and D's and F's on an English test.
Man.
And I went, the principal brought me in and told me that he heard I was screaming at my players against the wall. And I said, I think it's racist not to yell at them because it's the only language they know. They speak English. They have to be able to get through. These are all ninth graders. They have to get through ninth grade English. And I just don't know any other way to do it. And I'm very happy to say that, you know, all these kids were dying to do better in school and they just needed someone to challenge them. And so I got an email maybe 10 years ago from one of my players' wives. Right now he's probably 47. But so at this point, he was probably in his mid-30s, named Timmy. Timmy's wife, Charlene, emailed me. I never met her before on Father's Day. And she said that my husband never knew his dad. He's my husband and father of our three children. And he has mentioned you so many times over the years as being his dad. And I just wanted to thank you because he's a great husband and father. And of course, I bawled my eyes out.
Right, absolutely.
That.
Absolutely.
And that's what I'm supposed to do. To me, this is what we're supposed to do as coaches. And I by all means, I was not perfect. I started coaching Timmy when I was 23, my year before that, or 24. I was 22 when I first started coaching. And so, I mean, I had philosophies, but they weren't well thought out. They weren't nuanced. They weren't complex. And so I got better with all of that. But I know this, I was committed to them as individuals on day one. And it probably helped me that I was raised in part by a black woman named Diane Stotts. She was kind of our family housekeeper, but she was basically our second mom and lived with us. If my parents ever went out of town once or twice a year, she moved in. I probably went to her church more than I went to my temple growing up because I was raised Jewish. Diane and her family was our family. And I always tell people the story. At our family bar and bat mitzvahs, where four of us, Diane and her family sat at our family table. They didn't sit at another table. They sat at our table because they were our family. I never even thought of it any other way. And so she lived where a lot of my players were from, I learned. And it just wasn't hard for me to connect with them as human beings. And I'm so fortunate because, boy, these players, the players will do anything if you can help them play better. But it certainly helps if you also see them as people and try to inspire them to do better and to want more and to be ambitious about life, not just basketball. And so I think that helped them connect with me. I would argue that it was the most important thing. It wasn't the coaching I was doing. It was the man I was that helped us kind of connect.
Did your wife know what she was getting into before you guys got married, that she was going to have players at your house and all the things that went into it? How aware of what life she was getting into marrying a coach was she?
Yeah, no, not at all. She was a sophomore in college. When we first started dating, she married me. She wasn't even 22 yet. I just turned 25. And at that point, she knew. I said goodbye to her every summer for pretty much 10 weeks. My goal was to coach. I heard Ryan put on your show. I know you probably know that he assisted me for, you know, 14
years. Yes, absolutely.
Or yeah, it's like my son. I speak to Ryan probably more than any human on the planet that isn't my business partners or my family. Ryan, what he said is, you know, we try to coach. I told him this. I try to coach 100 games a year. So after 10 years, I'd have coached 1,000 games. So that meant all summer I was doing whatever camps I could work, fall leagues, sprint leagues. I did everything. And I mean, I say goodbye to this. I regret this now, to be honest with you. I've said this, and I have a 20-year-old son and daughter. My kids are twins. That I really should have done more for her. I'm just very lucky she had the grace and patience to wait me out. But I should have been taking her to the beach. And instead, I used to joke that I used to see my friends naked a lot more than I saw my wife naked back then, my girlfriend, in the summer, because we would do, you know, we live in dorms, and this is the life I led. And luckily, she was very involved. And first of all, she was graduating from college, and she was a very committed employee after that. And then she was willing to move with me. I was offered a job in Turkey. I remember calling her from, I think it was in Istanbul, when I got offered a job, and she was ready to move. And then I was offered some college jobs while I was a young basketball coach in the early 90s, and she was ready to go. And I didn't think it was the smartest move for us. And I don't regret it. I don't know if we would have made it if she had lived year-round that way. Because as a high school coach, yes, I was scouting all the time. I mean, I was scouting games. I was developing my players. I gave up playing myself on weekends so I could just do more player development for our players. And but I still saw her plenty. And had I been coaching in college, I'm not sure I would have. And I don't know if our marriage would have made it. It's impossible to guess. But she loved me and she supported me. And that's kind of always been, you know, what's mattered most is she was behind me and respected that I wasn't going to take her for granted. And I still hopefully don't ever do that.
Yeah, that balance is a huge
– yeah.
It's a huge thing, and it's something that I think so many coaches you see struggle with. And I know I have a lot of friends in the coaching profession that, you know, their marriages didn't survive because they were married to the game, and it's really easy to do. It's really easy to get caught up in your season and caught up in this, and I just got to do one more thing. And especially today, you think about, David, just how different in terms of the time demands, like what you were doing back in the time when you did it made you, I'm sure, very, very unusual. Whereas in today's game, I think the baseline of the amount of time you got to put in, whether it's as a high school coach or a college coach or, I mean, pro coach, whatever level, I think it's even higher than it's ever been. And there's a lot of coaches that struggle with that family and work balance and trying to figure out how can I do a service to both of them and not make sure I'm not neglecting one for the other. And it's a difficult line to walk, without question.
Yeah, I agree.
How, when you think back to those times in the summertime where you're cruising around the country doing camps, what's your favorite camp that you ever worked? Is there one that stands out to you that you're like, every time I went here, there were great people there, or the coaches that were part of the staff took you kind of under their wing and brought you behind closed doors? Was there one that stood out for you?
There was a few. So I worked Florida camp with against my first ever. I was able to coach a varsity, not our varsity. Another coach asked me, amazingly enough, Pinellas Park High School's head coach, Don Keller, asked me to take his team to Florida Gator team camp to teach them man-to-man, because he had a bunch of young, talented athletes and didn't know anything but zone. And he called my boss and said, do you mind if I borrow Coach Thorpe and let him take my team? So I'm 23 years old. I'm coaching varsity basketball alone. I had been coaching our team that whole spring, and we went undefeated in a spring league. In fact, I wrote about it in my book. It was like my first time coaching varsity. And we ended up going undefeated in an incredibly talented conference. Again, this was just for the spring league, not regular season. And so now I'm coaching a team camp, and my very first game was against Miami Senior High with Shaky Rodriguez. But Shaky isn't so famous outside Florida, although he did become a head coach at FIU and in Division I college for a while. His two assistants were Anthony Grant and Frank Martin. So I got to be really close with – I know Anthony well. I got really close with Frank. We're still buddies. And working those Gator camps over the years, because I had gone to school there. My brother was in med school for a while when I was working those camps. My closest friend in the world is probably Randall Leith, who was a player at Florida, became a great, great high school coach in Florida, and now is coaching up in Pennsylvania. We got to be super close, and he and his wife are godparents to my twins. And so that never happens if I'm not working those camps. I'd met him before, but it was the camps that really cemented our friendship. But the BC camps were great because there was so much talent. Kentucky's camp was fantastic. I drove my player there and a buddy of mine and his best player. And, but five-star was incredible. It was a life changer because I mean, I had Vince Carter, Steph Marbury, Tim Thomas, Jerry Stackhouse. I had so many great players in stations. And then I started coaching at the – first it was the middle – it's called the NCAA. I won my first NCAA championship, which was great. And then I started coaching the NBA players with, you know, tons of talent. NBA players were – that was their best seniors back then. And, you know, you're coaching – back – initially I was coaching – my first year I coached against Bob McKillop, who ended up, you know, coaching Steph at Davidson. I coached against Pete Strickland, who was a great coach in college, and I think he's doing some high school again now at DeMatha. So that was fun. And meeting all the college coaches who would come in to recruit. And I listened to Mike Fratello give an hour-long speech called The 8 Ways to Defend the Pick and Roll. I spent an afternoon talking to Bobby Hurley right after he trained with the Dream Team in 92. That summer, I picked him up from the airport, and we took him to lunch before he spoke to our camp, Bobby Hurley Jr. Yeah, you're just exposed to some great minds. And that's where I really learned that I could coach, because at 5-star, if you worked the better camps, they had a referee school going out at the same time, which meant you didn't have to referee. And because they wanted to be able to teach the referee stuff, we got 3 timeouts non-cum per half. And so there was no way we were using all 3 timeouts each half to run something. And I learned, Kevin Sutton and I became really close friends. He's a college coach now. He's down here at Florida Gulf Coast. He's been everywhere and coached a million great players and NBA players. I cut my teeth coaching against those guys. And so I developed a lot of my philosophies because of 5-star, you only got 30 minutes to practice one time. And so I was able to kind of, over the years, edit our playbook so that in 30 minutes, I can maybe get 10, 11, 12 plays in, from inbounds plays, sideline inbounds to half court, you know, attacks. And years later, I developed even more off of those initial 30-minute practices. And that really definitely made me a much better coach.
What do you think the game has both lost and gained in the way that the high school basketball summer scene has shifted from, okay, you're at 5-star, you're at Robert Morris, you're outside on the converted tennis courts, and yeah, you got all the best players in the country coming and they're playing on asphalt. And again, kids in that time, that's kind of the era I grew up in. I graduated from high school in 88, graduated from college in 92. So I grew up in that outdoor basketball era and going and playing at 5-star and all those things. And it's amazing to think that the best high school players in the country, if you were to tell them today that, hey, there used to be a time where everybody converged on these converted tennis courts and played outside in the hot sun for 8 hours on cement, and they'd look at you like you were crazy. And yet there's a lot of positives to that system, and there's a lot of positives to the system that we have today. So in your mind, just maybe compare and contrast the way basketball used to be with the way it is now. Give us some positives and negatives of each system.
Yeah, I won't just limit it to 5-star either. That was the only outdoor camp. I'm really friendly with Lee Klein, who is the son of one of the founders, Will Klein.
Yep.
5-star had a lot of real positives for me. I think we did almost everything wrong back then. Unfortunately, I'm not sure we're doing much more right now. I think their heart was in the right place back then, and it was their business. I don't know that we have the heart and the, like, Lee Klein lives the game and is all about the players for sure. I don't know that I found many AAU people that are similar. And I'm sure there are some. The guys that coached my son, of which I handpicked them, they were great guys. And that's why our AAU program was so great. But I didn't find most of our opponents to be cut of the same cloth. So I'll go into a couple of things. So first of all, when players are young, and this goes to not just summer camp, but the whole general sport itself, our only job as coaches / parents should be to help our players fall in love with the game, because the game is so hard. I coach NBA players now. I'm breaking down film on a daily basis. By 7 o'clock in the morning, I'm already into Synergy Sports, breaking stuff down. This morning, I was breaking down Wizards versus Nets from last night, which I actually watched the game live as well. It's a freaking hard game. And so if you don't love this, unless you're unbelievably gifted, like Lamar Odom may not have loved the game, I'm not sure. But he was such a gifted player. Tim Thomas was such a gifted player. he didn't really have to love it. But those guys are such rare examples of what human beings can look like. 6'9", super coordinated. They love the game enough to develop great skill. I don't know if they continue to love it as pros. That's a different question. But we have to get our guys to love it. And I don't know that we're – I don't think just playing games is enough. And I don't think just skill training is enough. And I don't know that you would call me the godfather of player development, but people say that all the time because I was the first one pretty much in America doing player development as a business. Everyone was doing it for their player. I didn't invent that. But the business of it was something that people think that I was the first one to do. And I'm unhappy to tell you that I think everyone's doing it wrong. And that is they're focused so much on the skill development and not the game development. And so my curriculum, for example, is based on game development, of which skill development is a part of it. And if I could wave a magic wand and go back and do it again, I would have raised money and built a business on game development. I never would have called it skill development because the idea is to help advance their game, not their skill alone. And so we have a lot of players. One example would be, and we'll talk about the NBA I know later, but going into this draft last summer, I rated Evan Mobley the number one prospect in the draft. I had Scottie Barnes barely behind him, coin flip at number two, and Cade Cunningham number three, and really didn't like Jalen Green very much at all because those other guys really understood how to play at a very young age and needed to develop their skills, whereas Green had great skill and athleticism and had no clue how to play. And I just think it's harder to teach someone how to play once you get to that level than it is to teach someone who knows how to play more skills. And this is where this is a failure of our institutions globally. And I'm someone who's coached, you know, I probably had 87, 88 NBA players. I probably had 150 guys that have played high levels of Europe. So it's the problem over there too. The problem over there is they tend to be turned more into schematic robots. I think Spain did that to Ricky Rubio a little too much. He got so caught up in being a game manager, lead guard, that he forgot to just go play and get buckets and score. And it prevented him from ever being an all-star, unfortunately. Whereas in America, we're so caught up in the ISO game, skill game, show what you can do as a dribbler shooter, that we don't teach them how to play the game, which is jazz. My book is called Basketball is Jazz for a reason. Scotty and Evan Mobley, and to a lesser extent, but still it's there, Kate Cunningham, they understand the jazz aspect of the game. And so I think that we've done a poor job of teaching that. And that has sapped some of the joy because I can tell you firsthand, my son, who plays college basketball, he was raised by me. So you're damn right he appreciates the jazz part of this game. He understands the we part of this game, not the me part. And takes great joy in that. And because of that, it's a richer experience for him. The players that are who find joy mostly from the me aspect of it are being robbed of the chance to love the we aspect of this. And it's not easy to get them to appreciate it later in life. So if I could wave that magic wand, it would be to really change and transform how we go about teaching the game and developing skill within game development as opposed to developing skill for just skill development alone.
All right. So there's a ton of stuff in there I want to ask you about. First, let's go back to the love of the game because I think that is 100% correct. I have conversations with parents all the time that want to talk to me or ask me questions about worrying about what's going to happen next. You know, I have a fifth grader. Well, how are they going to make it to the middle school team? And this, and you know, I got a middle school player. How are they going to be a high school player? I got a high school player. How are they going to be a college player? And ultimately, one of the things that I always try to tell them is, look, it's not really up to you. Like, it's really up to your kid. If your kid doesn't love it, they're never going to work hard enough at the game to be good enough to do the things that you think they should be doing. It's ultimately up to them. And I think you learn that. I'm not sure I would have had that same philosophy before I had my own kids. And once you have your own kids, you kind of realize that, like, you can put things in front of them. I can put basketball in front of them every day, but ultimately it doesn't matter unless they're going to pick up that ball and go and work at it and it means something to them. They're just never going to develop that love. So I think that's a great, great point and philosophy that you bring to the table where you say, hey, you got to love, you got to develop love for the game, especially at those lower levels, because we don't always do a good job of that. I think youth sports, in my mind, I think one of the problems is that we've developed it where it's almost become work. You know, you've got the 8-year-old kid who goes to travel basketball practice 2 or 3 times a week, and then they're with their speed, strength, agility person 2 or 3 times a week, and then they got their basketball trainer. And look, I know a lot of 7, 8-year-olds, and I don't know that many that want to play basketball 7 days a week for 2 or 3 hours a night. I just don't think those kids, there are some, but there aren't that many. And I think when we do that, we rob those kids of that ability to develop the love for the game. And I think the other thing that I started thinking about as you were talking is you go back to the era where you or I grew up, and we had an opportunity to go out and just play basketball without mom, dad, coach, referee, fans, and just kind of experiment and play and try stuff and do different things. And if I wanted to play a pickup game against some players that weren't as good as me, I could just use my left hand, or I could decide, hey, this game, I'm just going to try to pass and make my teammates better or whatever. And kids today don't get that opportunity. I think those are two things, that free play piece of it, I think, is a huge part of it. And then I think just turning youth sports into work is a challenge as we look forward. And I think, as you said, we have a lot of people out there that I think are well-intentioned, but I think there's a way we can do it better and do it differently where it's going to be good for the players, but it's also ultimately going to be good for our game.
Oh, yeah. How old are your kids?
So I have a senior who's my daughter's a senior. She stopped playing after her freshman year because she was a very average player. She just didn't, the players that were on her team, the relationship piece of it wasn't there for her. And so she didn't love basketball enough to kind of fight through the fact that she didn't have great friends on the team. And so when she walked away, she said, "Dad, I'm not having any fun anymore." And so she hung it up and walked away, and we were happy and everything was good. My son is a high school sophomore, and he was a kid who has always played basketball, but he didn't find that love until probably about 1.5 years ago. And suddenly that light bulb came on for him, which was a good day for me and a good day for him. But it was hard growing up as a kid who wanted more and more and more basketball. You couldn't have given me enough when I was a kid. And so to have a kid who wasn't wired like that initially was tough. And you have to really watch yourself and what you do. And then I have a 6th grade daughter who plays a bunch of sports still. So,
well, I like that. I didn't let my son played baseball when he was 5 with his twin sister.
Okay.
She stopped playing pretty quickly. He was actually much better at baseball, in part because you don't have to be so tall. And right. He played till 13, 14, and that's when he decided to go full-time basketball. But I didn't let him play basketball till he was 10. And because I wanted him to, I knew it would be in his life at some point. And he didn't really seem to care. And then once he played, so he played rec ball and it was okay. I coached it and the team was good. So it was a fun experience. But once he played AAU, and I let him play AAU starting in 6th grade.
Okay.
Real AAU, we played a couple of tournaments and got destroyed just so we could see what AAU was all about. But he wanted to do it in 6th grade. So we kind of joined an existing team, and I got real involved. I brought some coaches in and a one player besides my son. And it was amazing. And it ended his baseball career in 1.5 years, unfortunately, because my son told me the other day, he thought he could have played professional baseball, at least AAA level, because guys that he played with that was better than, he was better than them, even though he was much smaller, are high level Division I players. And my son was just a better prospect at that age.
Yeah.
I don't think he regrets it because he's in love with basketball. And so he has no regret. He just wonders, which is okay.
Right.
We all wonder.
For sure.
A lot of
absolutely.
But I'll tell you this on this subject. It's the single best story. Listen, I could bore you with 1,000 mistakes that I made in my career. I wrote about some of them in my book. And if I do another book, which I probably will, I'll write about more mistakes that I made. But you know this as a dad now. We do the best we can and we try to learn all the time, but we're never really sure. Just like as a coach, I'm never really sure when I speak to a guy that I haven't talked to in 15 years who I coached when he was 15, what did he think of me? You don't really know. I'm always a little nervous. Maybe I was a jerk to that guy. I don't know. So my wife was talking to our son the other day. And again, he's playing for one of the best programs in the country at Florida State. They're struggling right now because they lost 3 starters to injury, and it's a tough league when you lose 3 starters and plus some other injuries. but they had been leading the ACC at that point. So we had the biggest high was beating Duke at Florida State. He texted me at 2:30 in the morning and thanked me for everything I've done at that point, because he said I just had the best night of my life. So that was pretty great.
That's awesome.
But he spoke to my wife recently on the phone, and they were just talking about really tough coaches and the sport of basketball. And, you know, my son has teammates that play all over America from AAU and his post-grad high school team. He didn't go to post-grad, but his senior year, he actually played with a post-grad team just to get better experience. And so he's got a couple of those guys, and three of those guys playing college basketball too. And they were talking about how tough some coaches are. And my wife said, who's known me pretty long time, she said, wouldn't you say your dad was tough? Like he was, I thought he was really tough. And Max said, no, he's like, dad built relationships. So when he was tough, he did it from a point where everyone understood what he was saying and everyone loved him for it. And I could cry right now knowing, yes, I didn't hear this conversation, but the fact that my son got it told me that I actually did it right. I tried. Yep. I've told them so many times over the years. And right when my dad died, I left both my kids messages on WhatsApp, voice messages, and just saying, like, help me be a better dad by just telling me when I'm screwing up. Like, I don't want to screw up. You're 20 now. You're allowed to live your own life. And over the years, and I said this to each of them, I've worked at pulling myself away more and more, because I can't fix all your mistakes, and I don't need to be. I always tell my daughter, you can tell me anything, but you don't have to tell me everything. It's on you. But there's nothing that you don't have to, that you feel like you can't approach your subject. I said, I was there the millisecond you came out of your mom. I was holding your left ankle. Like, I can hear all of it, but you don't have to tell me any of it. It's your choice. But I am not going to intrude. I have to give you space. And I intentionally missed some of my son's AAU practices and games, some of his high school practices and games. Many of them, actually, I stopped going to practice his last couple of years to give him that space, hoping that one day he would come back to me and we'd be best friends for life. And now, of course, I don't miss a second, although he's not playing right now because Florida State's just got more good players than they have playing time available for him. He's super focused on getting better, and he wants to earn playing time next year, and I'll do everything I can to help him. But I don't miss a single thing. And if he was playing, I don't know if I'd go to every game or not. I'd probably consider it. Because this is it. Once he's done, if he wants to play professionally for a couple of years, that'd be great. But I won't be traveling overseas a lot to watch him play. It's his own life. But I think we did it right. Basketball can really help us teach young people on more important life lessons. And we use sports as a tool for that. I've always used sports as a tool for that. It all comes down to one fundamental fact. 7 days a week at 6 a.m., almost exclusively for 5 or 6 years, my son was out working on his ball handling in our driveway. I didn't do it. I actually felt great relief when he went away and I could be in my office and I couldn't even hear any balls bouncing in our front driveway, because every time I did, which was every single day for 6 straight years, I had asked myself, do I go out there? Do I wait for him to ask me to go out there? How long do I stay out there? I have to earn a living, but I want to help him, and I'm a good coach. And it was a balancing act that was so stressful for me. And I'm so relieved that I don't have to do that anymore. I've handed him off to an amazing coaching staff in college, and I don't even ask him anything. They coach him the way they want to coach him. He asked me the other day, I saw him play in person. He asked me what I thought of his shot. And I said, it doesn't matter. I'm not coaching you anymore. When you get home this summer, if you want me to tweak your shot, we can talk about it. But they're your coaches now. I'm not. But it all comes from that love of wanting to compete, wanting to get better. And the other part too is that we part. I told you he really gets it. He told me once that these players aren't just his brothers. He's their brother. This is at Florida State, but it was that way in high school too. They were. In fact, the other day, he sent me a picture of three of his JV teammates who went to hang out with him one weekend, just last weekend. They went to hang out with him and go to the game and everything. That's what sports can do. And we used it the right way. And for him, and my daughter was a dancer. And I can tell you the same things about that in dance. And her best friends are dancers that she met when she was in fifth grade or sixth grade. That's how we use sports the best way, I think.
Yeah, you make your story rings so true to life to me, because I think the two things that I took from that are, one is that as a parent and as a coach, you don't ever know if you're doing it right, because you can't go back and replay it the opposite way. So just like you, could I have, from the time my kids were 5 years old, could I have dragged them to every single basketball event, skill clinic, whatever, games? Could I have dragged them to every single thing that I went to or wanted to go to? Sure, I could have, but I didn't. And not that that was always easy, because as a competitive person, as a person who loved the game of basketball, and as a person who had such great experiences with it, and as you said, learned so much about the person who I am, was shaped by the game of basketball. There's no way around that. And so you kind of want to have your kids have a similar experience because of how good the game has been to me. So it was an internal debate, just like you. You're sitting there, you're going, should I, shouldn't I, should I, shouldn't I? And eventually you just have to make a decision of what direction you think is right. And then the other thing that struck a chord with me is that I think when I looked at why I made the decision that I did, and again, you can say, do you think it worked out well or didn't work out well, whatever. I think to this point, it's worked out pretty well. But I think ultimately what's most important is not what kind of basketball player they are, but what kind of human being they are. And that when they're 25, that you have the kind of relationship that you're going to have with your son and your daughter, where they're going to call you up and they're going to be a friend, and it's going to be a different kind of relationship. And it's not going to be something where, man, dad was such a jerk that he dragged me to all this stuff. And, you know, by the time I was 12, I hated basketball, but I just kept going because I didn't. And then that relationship is soured. And so I think there's no perfect answer, and there's probably different answers that are right for different people and different families and different kids. But as you said, we're all flying by the seat of our pants as a parent, for sure. You're just throwing things up against the wall to see if you can figure out what's going on. So I could completely relate to your story. And it's one that I think anybody who has a kid who's an athlete in any sport, or you're a musician or whatever it might be, I just think you have to try to find where's that line where, you know, you can't just let them sit on the couch and eat chips all day. But at the same time, you can't drag them to everything, right? I mean, you can't force them, because I think ultimately if they don't love dance or they don't love the violin or they don't love basketball, like we talked about earlier, they're just not going to – it's never going to pan out for them, because if you don't love it, you're just not going to spend the time.
Yeah. I mean, when the pandemic first hit, my son and daughter were seniors in high school, and my daughter had just quit dance because of an injury. And my son was getting ready to – at that point, we had visited Florida State. He had made his decision, I'm going there, and playing on the team. And but we were in a lockdown. No gym was open, whatever. So he went to his cousin's house religiously and lifted weights in his cousin's garage, who lived a couple blocks away from us. And he got really strong, because that's what college athletes do in a pandemic, is they don't stop.
Right, absolutely.
They work their ass off. We got him running miles and run sprints, and this is just doing jump rope. And it's just all – I remember hearing, when he was old enough to drive, he would back our cars out of the driveway when it was pouring rain. I'm sorry, out of the garage, so he could do his ball handling in the garage. Like, there's no excuse. This summer, I was talking to him, and he was a little tired. I said, why are you so tired? You guys aren't even starting your training yet. He said, well, he mentioned a couple of teammates' names. He's like, you know, we've been doing some 5:30 a.m. sandpit workouts in preparation for our sandpit program in the fall. I'm like, Matt's like 5 weeks away. What are you doing? He's like, well, we just want to get a head start. Like, this is what college athletes do. And the average person doesn't understand the level of commitment to the game on all aspects of the game, to include learning how to be a better teammate, learning how to cheer better, which is something – that is something my son didn't have a lot of practice in. But none of that happens without really being in love with it. And we can't make our kids love anything. I always laugh when I hear – people say, well, he's just like his parents. Not my son, just kids in general. Kids don't, 50-50 at best, whether they're going to be like their parents. They don't learn. Yep. Just because a parent does something doesn't mean they'll do it too. In fact, they often do the opposite. So we can model the best behavior we can, but they got to make choices, and we try to talk them through it. But I know this for my son and I, it was our love language. And anytime you want to get to know a young boy, a teenage boy, that's your son or a nephew, just get him to get something to eat, and they'll always talk if you feed them.
That is true. That is 100% true, David.
So when I wasn't feeding them, how I got my son to talk was I'd say, hey, you know, did you see the Clippers just picked up? Or did you watch the Warriors the other day? Boom. That was it. Like, he and my daughter and I had a very different conversation, because she could care less. We had Marvel movies, my son and I, and we had, which I'm so thankful for, and we had basketball. And he wants to make a living at it. He wants to, at this point, he still thinks he wants to be a team executive. And so now we're having conversations about trade deadlines and salary cap and finance. And these are new things that he's going to have to learn. But he's watching. We never watched college basketball. I watched NBA basketball. So did he. And now if I say, what are you doing tonight? He'll say, well, there's this game on, all college. Because these are potential competitors in the NCAA tournament years in the year past and or in the ACC. Like, he's so in love with that new thing now. And I am just a listener, and he'll tell me why. Like, he was telling me about the kid, Trey Murphy, the Virginia player at New Orleans. Max played against Virginia.
Okay.
He knew all about this kid. And so it's great. I'm getting scouting reports from him now. And I might say, what's the key to attacking Syracuse's zone? And my son has a really, really good answer. Really good answer. Because he is living this stuff. So that's great. I could, you know, this is, I could nerd out on that stuff all day. Obviously, I'm a coach.
Yeah.
And so it's very really cool. Interesting.
It's funny. Yeah. It's funny that you say that. So my son has never been a kid really that has watched the game. But now that he's gotten into high school basketball, he'll watch high school games. So he'll watch teams that he's playing against or teams that are coming up on the schedule, or he'll watch two teams that his team's already played against. So that's interesting to have those conversations. And then my daughter, who doesn't play basketball anymore, she's my NBA person. So her and I'll sit down, and yesterday trade deadline, we're talking things, and just, you know, she's a huge Cavs fan. So we'll sit down and watch a Cavs game together, and we're not watching on the same level as a coach. And she's not obviously a player, but it's just fun to have somebody in the house who wants to talk NBA, which I have never had up until, you know, 4, 5, 6 years ago when the Cavs made it all the way to, you know, the championship and with LeBron. And my daughter at that time was, what, she was 11. So we had a whole corner of the house that was set up with, you know, all this Cavs stuff. And it was just, you know, it was a blast. And those are the things that as a parent, you just can't, I mean, you just can't compare to those. That it goes without saying. All right, I want to go back in time to how you made the transition from high school coaching to being a player development coach. And then obviously being much more than that to the guys that you work with in the league. So how do you go from, I'm a high school coach, and obviously you had a lot of connections through going to camp and working and that kind of thing. So just how does that transition happen?
It was, I made a decision that I wasn't going to stay as a high school coach. There wasn't enough income for what I was hoping to accomplish in my career, in my life. And I didn't love the profession for different reasons that I won't get into now. And I was worried that my marriage, which was, I thought, very strong, wouldn't be able to last in college as a college coach, because I had friends who were already kind of losing their marriages. And it just so happened that I was working some games as an announcer locally here. And we took it, our area in Clearwater had like state-of-the-art equipment for games. We were winning Cable Ace Awards back in the, I wasn't, but their technical crews were winning it in the early 90s. They took it very seriously, expensive equipment. So I was doing games of the week every Friday night, of which I still have some of those videos. It's really funny. And parents would come up to me, and they knew me because I'd worked camps all summer, and I knew their kids. Even though they played at rival schools of mine, I would coach their kids, at their sons at camp. And so they, it just one player, Colin McCoy, at $25 an hour, asked me if I would work with him on his game. And it grew to a business where I had 75 players coming every week, more or less, from around the west coast of Florida. And that's how the basketball academy grew. And then I was still doing some other things in business, managing sporting events. And a guy that I met at Five Star became an agent. And they were, his company represented Tim Duncan, Grant Hill, Tracy McGrady. And they were trying to represent Trajan Langdon, the great player from Duke, who's now the GM of the Pelicans. And Trajan didn't take them. And the head agent, Lon Babbie, asked, if you don't mind me asking, what was it that we didn't offer that your agent that you chose did? He said, well, you have no one to do draft prep for me. And that back then, NBA draft prep was very in its infancy. So this agent, Lon Babbie, ended up going, who eventually became the president of the Phoenix Suns. But back then, he was an agent and an attorney for a very powerful law firm named Williams & Connolly in D.C. He went to one of his young underling, you know, lawyers for the company who was helping him and said, we need someone to do draft prep. And that person, his name is Jason, called me, said, do you still train players? I said, not so much anymore. And he said, well, I think, you know, we can get you some pretty good players. So the very first draft I did, I had Chris Carwell from Duke, McDonald's and college All-American at Duke his senior year, and Bootsy Thornton from St. John's, and a guy named Olumide Oyedeji, who was drafted by the Sonics. Carwell was drafted. Carwell was an assistant with Coach K, now has been for 20 years. He ended up being drafted by the Spurs. So during that time, and then I started helping a player named Udonis Haslam, who had just played a year in France after being undrafted out of Florida. And he came to train with me to get ready for summer league for both the Heat and the Spurs in summer league. And he made the Heat. He ended up getting offered a very short, a guaranteed deal, low money, short on money, I mean. And I learned very quickly that I can, like, he needs more help than just getting ready for summer league or the draft. I can make this a business. And so starting with Udonis, I realized I can start helping players at the highest level get ready for whatever summer programs they're in, the draft, summer league, and then during the season. And I kind of built a year-round business for that. And I've been doing that other than, you know, my writing at ESPN. And now I'm a partner at True Hoop. I've been doing this, you know, since 1999, basically.
Too bad Haslam didn't have a long career that you could have played off, right?
I remember I wrote this in my book. We were sitting at a Greek place that's still open right now in Northwood Plaza in the countryside area of Clearwater. And I had four or five players in town, but he and I were sitting at the same table. We're sitting outdoors because we had just worked out. All the guys were sweaty. We were having lunch. And he looked at me. He was 22 years old. And he said, "Coach Thorpe, do you really think I have a chance to make it in the league?" Like he really didn't know. You know, 20 years later, he's still playing.
It's amazing.
So it's amazing. Yeah, I love Udonis. He was very influential for me, taught me a lot, very brilliant player. And but yeah, that's how it started.
That's incredible. All right, I want to ask you just a general player development question based off of what you said a little bit earlier when you talked a little bit about the difference between developing skills in isolation versus developing skills that can actually be applied in the game. And I think one of the things when I look at basketball today, I see players at the high school level that if you compare them to players 20 or 30 years ago, the players at the end of the bench are way, way, way more skilled, things they can do with the ball shooting wise than players 20 or 30 years ago. But I'm not certain that those players' IQs are close to the players that played in the past. And so how do you go about, what are some things, if you were to have a conversation with somebody who wanted to start a training business or somebody who was already training players, and you said, here's a way to do it better, what are a couple things that you would tell them that they should think about or that they should look at in terms of improving the way they work with players to make sure that the skills they're teaching are translatable to games?
Okay, so first of all, let me address what you said. Unequivocally, the players today are every bit as good as they were back then, if not in many cases, way better. That being said, I understand your point. I don't think they have a better feel. So if you take your best players from your high school teams, I have videotape of my teams in the 80s. Well, I watched a tape the other day from a very, very good team I had in 1991-92 season. And the team we played ended up losing the state championship game. And we are the only team to beat them until they lost in that playoff game. And those players are every bit as good, those top 10, as what we see now on most teams, you know, for high school. Obviously, ones that went to college.
For sure.
So you're not wrong that those players then, in terms of feel, we have that too here. We have plenty of guys with amazing feel now. The problem is, Mike, we have way more skilled players now, which is dangerous if they don't know how to play. Jalen Green this year at one point for the Rockets was, I think he was 1-18 and then 2-24 in games he appeared in. Meanwhile, the team had won not a ton, but a lot more games than that. He had no idea how to play basketball, but because he's got all this skill and athleticism, you kind of get caught up in that and you forget that, you know, it's about winning games. So to answer your great question, I think players need to play a lot more. And they need to play a lot more without mom and dad or coach watching. They've got to just play. The challenge is we need to ask them to try to remember some reference points. I have a chapter in my book called Embrace the Suckiness. I think Pannon may have mentioned on your podcast.
Yeah, Ryan and I talked about that.
Yeah, that came from me talking to my son about he couldn't get a hit in baseball. And he finally came up to me when he was 9 years old, and they had moved him up to playing with 11 or 13-year-olds, but because of his fielding and pitching, not because of his hitting, against guys that in some cases were shaving. My son was 9. And he said, "Dad, I just want to get a hit." And he was crying. And I said, "Well, we first have to admit that you really suck at hitting." And I don't know why I did it. I'm not a sadistic person. And he's like, "Yeah, I suck at hitting." I said, "Who cares?" I said, "This is the point. What does it matter if you suck? You're 9 years old. Why do you care? Let's just get better. Don't attach emotion to the suck part. Let's just get better." So that's where this all came from. So that's what playing does. If you're playing a lot of 1-on-1, 2-on-2, 3-on-3, 4-on-4, 5-on-5, or 21, or whatever game you want, and you suck at it, keep track of what you're bad at. That's how we inform the curriculum for our practices. That's how you inform the curriculum for your own workouts. What are you doing on your own? This is where I think we have failed so dramatically is that's one area is I don't think our guys play enough games that don't matter. The problem is in AAU, every game seems to matter. That's bad. As an example, I'll give you, I started coaching JV also. Well, I coached my fraternity when I was a sophomore in college, but my first game, my first job as an adult after college was coaching JV and assisting varsity. And if you try to make a left-hand layup on the left side and missed, we gave you a standing ovation. We did pumpers in games. Forget practices. I didn't care if you missed it in a game. The process was what mattered. And if you, in most cases in AAU, losing matters. If there's a consequence to it that the coach values too much and the player consequently values too much. And so they stick with what they can do and they don't develop what they can't do. Does that make sense?
No, it makes total sense. I think that goes back to that free play point that I was making where when you're always in a gym where people are watching and there's a scoreboard, You're a lot less likely to get creative and try things that maybe are a little bit beyond what you're capable of doing in the moment. Whereas when I was 9 years old and on my driveway and playing 1-on-1 up to 100 with one of my buddies, I mean, I could try whatever and I could shoot a 30-footer. I could shoot the reverse layup. I could use whichever hand. I could do anything because there was nobody standing on the sideline, right. A, keeping score, or B, telling me what I was doing right or wrong. And I think that it's a challenge for coaches to be able to, I think, build some of that free play into it. I think you make a great point about left-handed layups. I did that with my son's team, my daughter's team, all the time. Same thing with the left-handed layup. It's just, come on, if you want them to shoot a left-handed layup and then it's in a game and they shoot a left-handed layup, they miss, and then you yell at them, which we've all seen, right? I mean, you've seen it, and I'm sure, you know, as your kids are growing up, and you just look at coaches and you're like, man, if you just would not worry so much about winning that third grade basketball game, you could give your kids such a better experience and they could become better basketball players and the game would be more fun and we'd all be better off for it.
Yeah. So I think, would you say that most people listening to this podcast are actually coaches?
Yeah, I would say mostly we have coaches.
Okay. So let me tell them a story because this goes to what you're describing right now about where our values have to be. So imagine having coached scores of NBA players like I have, and being an NBA analyst at ESPN for a decade, which I have done, and writing a book called Basketball is Jazz, and having success at high school and AAU and all of that, which I've done. So imagine you're coaching AAU, or in the case I'm going to tell you right now, high school varsity summer basketball, what it's like for these other guys when they coach against me. To beat Coach Thorpe in a game is a big deal.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And one thing I love to say is that, you know, I have a lot of confidence in what I do, but I have no pride. I believe pride is a big problem. If I want to win a game and I come up with a strategy, man, I'll get another strategy so fast if I realize I was wrong. Like, I just have no pride. I'll change up until Ty Lue is the way of the Clippers. He's played more lineups than anyone last year in the postseason, yep. And they ended up beating the Jazz.
Right.
I don't have any pride when it comes to stuff like that, nor do I think that if I lose, there's somehow better coach than me. I just see a bigger purpose. I'm also almost 57. Next Wednesday, I'm 57. So I've been around a little bit. So one time I'm coaching, I'm coaching my son's kind of like, I guess you would call him ninth grade JV, but we had, We took a couple players from another team, not very good players, because it was more of an AAU event, and these were young men that I knew. And we're playing against a high school varsity coach that I knew well, and he brought his – we were ninth graders. We were playing up against 10th graders. He had his 10th grade team, and we were beating them. We played really well. We were beating them, and he was coaching like it was the end of the world, and only his best six or seven were playing because he wanted to beat me, and I knew that. And I'm friendly with the guy. He was fine. I was playing everyone because it was an AAU game in May. Like, what does it matter if you win? It was a nighttime game.
Right.
And I, late in the game, they were making a nice little comeback. And he called a timeout. I think we were up three with maybe a minute to go. He called timeout frantically after they made a basket, and he was out of timeouts. And, meanwhile, he did not know he was out of timeouts because, you know, these AAU tournaments, the young girl, you know, some teenage right. girl, At the scorer's table, who knows if he really was out of timeouts.
Yep.
She claimed she had told him, but I didn't know. So I said to the referee, so of course it's a technical. I said to the referee, can we just ignore the tech and just play? I said, you know, these kids, you're all paying $10 a game. They're not really paying attention. I didn't ever hear her say that they're out of timeouts. The referee's like, no, I told him. I said, listen, can you just cancel the tech? He said, no. I said, well, I'm telling you, I'm going to tell my player to shoot two air balls. So it's our ball anyway because they had just scored. Can we just have the ball out of bounds and save the trouble of me having someone shoot two air balls? And the referee was pretty shocked. And we ended up – I'm almost positive we won the game because I think I wrote about it on Facebook and saw that memory like 5 years ago. This was, you know, six, seven, 8 years ago. And I got a lot of comments after the game from the parents from the opponent. Their head coach never said a word to me, which kind of, I thought he should have, but
right.
The parents saw what I did and they knew who I was. And my point is none of you out there, well, almost none of you anyway, are going to be at the level I've been at. I'm lucky as hell for sure. But if I could swallow my pride and put my reputation at risk to lose a stupid-ass ninth-grade AAU game, so can you. Because what I was trying to get done with those players had nothing to do with whether or not we won that game. And it certainly had nothing to do with my ability as a coach. I wanted these guys to fight their rear ends off against an older team. That was their own high school team. We had players from a couple different teams and from two different schools, Clearwater and Countryside High School. They were just all friends, and we just wanted to compete our butts off and play the right way. We just have to stop with those egos and the pride and see the big picture. And it isn't hard to see as adults. It's just hard to do if you're caught up in your own ego. We need to get past that.
Yeah, and I think what I've found is that if you've had some success yourself in the game, I find it, at least for me, I find it to be much easier to step back from an ego standpoint, because I did things like my time. I don't want to say my time is past, but my time is past. You know, my days of being worried about, am I going to be in the newspaper or is somebody going to come up and pat me on the back after I win a sixth grade travel basketball game? I'm not really that worried about that stuff anymore. And so it right. really has to be more about the kids and developing them and making them better and all those kinds of things. All right. I know that I want to talk some topical NBA stuff, and we have about 5 or 6 minutes left. So
yeah,
I can go
a little longer if you want.
All right,
let's cover whatever you want to cover.
All right, let's do that. So let's start with obviously the biggest topic, and then I want to talk a little Cavs too, since I'm here in Cleveland.
Sure.
Let's start with the Harden Simmons trade. I'm going to throw two things at you, and I'm going to play devil's advocate, and then I'll let you agree, disagree with me, tell me where the nuances are with what I'm about to say. So Philly gets Harden, and now he's basically tanked his way out of two straight teams. So you bring him in. How happy is he going to be? How well does he fit with Embiid? And then you take into account when the biggest moments in the playoffs, you can make a pretty good argument that he hasn't been at his best in the biggest moments when his team has needed him. So that's my devil's advocate against Harden going to Philly. And then on the Simmons side of it, and I'm curious to hear from you on this one, with Simmons, the last time we saw him, he's shooting 32% from the line in the playoffs, which is clearly a case of not necessarily his fundamental skill, but that's something going on mentally, like a golfer that has the yips. And I think that's very difficult. I went through something like that in college with free throw shooting, and it took me a little bit of time to get over it. I was shooting like 90% as a sophomore, and I went one for my last 10 as a sophomore. And then I eventually got it up. As a junior, I shot 76%, and then as a senior, I shot 82%. But I was a better free throw shooter in high school before that happened to me. But I overcame it. But I wonder, you know, everybody's kind of penciling Simmons in as he's just going to come on in and be, you know, once he gets back in shape, that he's going to be the Ben Simmons when he was at his best. And I wonder if, you know, the mental side of it, and not the mental health side of it, but just the being able to get up to the free throw line. And look, he doesn't have to shoot 90%, but he's got to be able to make 65-70%, or else teams are just going to start hammering them. So just curious what your take is on those two things, and then kind of how you feel like it's going to play out.
So I published a big article about this yesterday right after. I actually have two different pieces this week at TrueHoop.com.
I got it right in front of me. I read them both.
Oh, great. So the one on Embiid and Simmons, on Simmons and Harden. So in the case of Philadelphia, I mean, James Harden at any point is better than no Ben Simmons.
Right. Absolutely.
I argued back in the fall they should go after Derek White and DeJounte Murray from the Spurs. I feel very good right now that had they done that, they'd be better off in the next 5 years than having James Harden right now. DeJounte Murray's an all-star and he's 25. Derek White just went to Boston. Both are close to being elite level players. Derek White's top 5% in the league in defense. DeJounte Murray suddenly has become top 10% on offense, after having been top 10% on defense in the past. And again, just 25 years old. So I think Daryl should have done that. But Harden's better than nothing. I think Harden knows. Zach Lowe, my buddy, who does his own pod, obviously, at ESPN, he talked about it this morning that Harden's on alert now. Like, you can't do this anymore. And that matters. Like, James knows he can't suddenly complain about Joel Embiid. No one's going to listen to the boy cried wolf. He'll be done. So he's going to have to play. I think he'll fit in just fine with Joel Embiid. The world's best players always find a way to fit in. I gave this example to Henry Abbott, my partner Troop, yesterday. Did you happen to watch, Mike, the Beatles documentary, Get Back?
I heard the Simmons podcast, but I have not watched it yet.
So in the second one, there's a famous jazz keyboard player that's often called the Fifth Beatle. And he's called that because initially he came to London. They had been playing in Hamburg, Germany when they were a young band, and he had been playing for a different band in Hamburg, Germany in the early 60s, and they knew him. And so he came by and they just said, "Hey, do you mind, you know, sitting in on some of these things that we did?" Well, meanwhile, it's on camera. We watched it and we listened to it. And they were incredible. You would have thought he'd been with the Beatles for years. And my point is, at the highest level, these brilliant basketball players are just like these brilliant musicians. In just the blink of an eye, they figure it out. So we don't have any concerns about how Joel Embiid and James Harden can figure it out. It's like getting two mathematicians in a room to solve an equation. I promise you, they will solve it. Okay? That will be the issue. The issue is James Harden, as we age as players, We can't do the same thing nearly as frequently as we once could. So Kobe Bryant had, whatever, 60. I watched his last game. But he wasn't doing that every game. It's not possible as you get older. You have moments. It's no different than aging as a human being. There are times my dad, while he was dying in his last year, there were days where he actually felt pretty good. But when he was 50, he had most days where he was feeling pretty good. When he was 30, every day felt pretty good. It's the same thing with professional athletes at the highest level. So we're going to see Harden be amazing less than we used to. Might it be enough to win a championship? Sure. Joel Embiid is one of the two best players in the world, one of the three best. Giannis and Jokic might be better. It's you know, splitting hairs. They're all the same. They're all beyond great. So, and LeBron's still pretty damn good. So I think that they'll be very good. I have them third or fourth best in the league by season's end, as they kind of work some things defensively out, which is where I think they'll be more challenged. The Ben Simmons thing, I think you make a great point. Just because he's out of Philly doesn't mean he'll make free throws. Now, he shot better from the line than he did in the postseason, but I think you're right. I think that there's real concerns there. I heard someone say today that he won't even come back until Durant is back because he wants that cover. Wow. He does want to come in. I mean, if they come back to a home game, there'll be no Durant and no Irving until after the All-Star break. And that might be something he can't handle. We don't know. We don't know if it's all a ruse to get out of Philly. He clearly had some mental issues. There's no doubt of that. But we don't know how severe they were. We're going to find out. And so, no, I think that long-term, Brooklyn won this trade. Short-term, Philly won it. And that could work to each advantage over time. It's possible that both are true. One team is better in the short-term. One team is better in the long-term.
Yeah, the best version of Simmons clearly fits really well with with Kyrie and
I think so.
With Durant. I mean, it's just, you know, you look at what he can bring to the floor defensively, and again, just as a distributor. And Kyrie and Durant, obviously the shooting that the two of those guys bring is just is incredible. All right, talk some Cavs with me.
Sure.
So clearly nobody really saw this coming, at least in terms of the success that they've had wins and losses wise. I think there were a lot of people that obviously, like Evan Mobley, people thought that Garland was going to be able to take a leap and that he was going to continue to improve. And then Jared Allen, you get him as a throw-in from the last Harden trade. And hard to believe that Houston didn't want this guy. And they've just – all those guys have developed at a much faster pace than clearly anybody thought. And so now you have this team that's sitting a game and a half out in the Eastern Conference, and they go out and get – Caris LeVert. So what's your thoughts on how LeVert fits? I know that I think you like that particular fit for the Cavs, and he certainly brings something that they didn't have, his ability to put the ball on the floor and create offense, where previously they only had basically Garland is the only guy who's got any kind of creativity, especially in the half court. But just defensively, this team is so good. So how do you see LeVert fitting in, and what do you think what's the ceiling for the Cavs if things go perfectly for them? What's their ceiling?
Well, we know, I just was reading a study about this recently. We know the placebo effect is a real thing, and there's so much evidence of it in the medical profession. If you believe something, you can make it be the case, whether it should be or not. And I think Cavaliers players believe Caris LeVert is going to be a big key for them going forward. What he does offensively, his ability to generate points on his own as a playmaker, not just a scorer. He should be able to, you know, there's such an elite defensive team, the best defensive team in the league right now. Mobley's a big part of that. So is Jared Allen.
Yep.
And LeVert definitely is not a defender, but can be when you're playing for, in their minds, a number one seed. So he'll compete his butt off, and he does have to carry a load offensively. They got, you know, Darius and the system itself for that. And they got Kevin Love off the bench helping, and he's an incredible player in his own right and has been for a long time. So I think they believe, and that's big. You got to believe. Now, belief only gets you so far when you run into another team that believes too, and they're better than you. And so what my fear is that they're going to be a 3 seed, and they're going to have to play the Raptors at a 6 seed. And I think Toronto's going to beat them if that's the case. Now, we're a long way to go from there, okay? Toronto could go higher than that. They're on an 8-game win streak, and they're playing great. And Siakam is playing – he deserves an All-NBA. It's a joke that he's not an All-Star. Joke. That LaMelo
he's
got
been,
it over him.
He's been incredible since he came back. I mean, he's been unbelievable.
Oh, my God. So I think when you ask me about ceiling, I think their ceiling this year is to win a series. And that's no knock on them. The East is just loaded. Loaded. When you think about Brooklyn might be the 8 seed.
Yeah.
They might be the 8 seed. So how about that? Cleveland clinches the first seed, and then they got to play that team with Ben Simmons and Kyrie.
Yep.
And the first two games, Kyrie plays. It's in Cleveland. So I think a series is – I just am a big believer that you got to have pain before you win a lot. I think you have to go through a lot of frustration and pain. And Cleveland as a city has done that, as a franchise has done that, but not in the postseason with these guys. So – I think that if they can win a series, incredible. If they can finish top four in the East, incredible. And I wrote an article about them last month called "Hello Cleveland" from the old what was that movie? The funny movie about the band that the fake rock and roll band, the mockumentary.
Oh gosh,
Spinal Tap. This is Spinal Tap.
Yeah, thank you.
Hello
thank
Cleveland.
You.
So I named it that. They're going to be contending for championships for a while. I just love Mobley so much. I love Jared Allen. I love Darius Garland. I think Isaac Okoro can be a workable glue guy for them if he'll buy into that. I think Colin Sexton, we did our show today, our podcast called Bring It In. Our show today, we talked about I think Sexton should agree to be a sixth man for them. And I think that'd be a dynamic play for him and for them. Otherwise, they have to solve that problem. How do we generate big-time scoring on our bench unit? Not easy to do. Lou Williams, Jamal Crawford kind of guy, Bobby Jackson from back in the day with the Kings.
Yep.
I'd love him to do that. I don't know if he's willing to do it. He's another young player, and he may feel like he should be the Darius Garland for some other team. I don't agree with him. I think he should be a sixth man for that team. But no matter what, they have a core in place you guys should be very excited. You should be great for years to come.
What's Mobley's ceiling? How good can he be? Can he be a top five player in the league? I mean, obviously what he's doing defensively this year is unprecedented for a guy who's a rookie big man.
I thought Jaren Jackson Jr. was the best prospect in the same draft with Luka. And I thought he could be Tim Duncan 2.0. I'm not wrong. He's coming around now. He's starting to show it. And look how good Memphis is.
Absolutely.
But Evan Mobley is Tim Duncan 2.0. He's not really the shooter from three that needs to be. To be the 2.0 version, you got to play in the perimeter more defensively, which we do now more in the league. And you got to be able to make outside shots. Mobley is better on the first than, he's not yet a shooter. But I think he's going to be. So I think he's going to be a Tim Duncan-like player. He's going to be up for all defensive player of the year, all NBA, and he's going to be a first ballot Hall of Famer. That's what I think.
I've never seen a guy get to spots on the floor on both ends who appears to be moving in, I don't want to say slow motion, but he just, all of a sudden he's there and it never looks like he's sprinting. It never looks like he's moving fast, but it's just all of a sudden he is there and he just swallows guys up at the rim. It's incredible to watch.
Yeah, just for all the coaches out there, I was working with an NBA starter earlier this winter, a center, a big athletic, very talented center, but really quick and fast and jumpy. And I spent an hour showing him Jokic tape. And I showed him, and he was laughing his ass off at Jokic. And he'd run a pick and roll at the top of the key with Jamal Murray or someone. And then I would do like a do-do-do-do-do-do because he would just kind of stroll to the rim and the ball would come right to his hands off a rebound or off a pass and he would lay it up or dunk it, whatever. And everything was just like do-do-do-do-do-do and he was always where he's supposed to be. And my point I was making to him is you don't always have to rush. That's the feel. That's the art. And you're exactly right. Mobley and Scotty Barnes have that gift of just the game has a feel. There are some players who don't have a great feel but can be great players. Their craft is great. Their athleticism is great. Their discipline is great. They don't get themselves in trouble, all that. But the guys where the game just makes sense, they have to work on their game. Just like a musician may have a talent, an ear for music, but they still got to work on their craft or they just will have a talent that isn't developed. So Mobley has that feel like Jokic where he just, the game makes sense to him, and it's like I said, he and Scottie Barnes I could watch all day because they just the game just is in their bones, you know.
Absolutely, it's interesting just talking about being able to play with pace and understanding that you don't have to be going a million miles an hour. And you watch again. I've been watching a lot of high school basketball with my son playing, and the number you see the good players, and obviously you know this intuitively as a player or as a coach, but the best players are the ones that can change speeds and play at different tempos. And then the players who aren't as experienced are just going a million miles an hour all the time. And they just don't understand and have that feel for the game like we've been talking about all throughout this. Dave, I mean, I can't thank you enough, David, tonight for taking an hour and a half out of your time to jump on with me. And it's been a lot of fun learning more about just your background and where you came from. And I've been listening to you on Zach's podcast every year with the playoff preview. So it was fun to get on and have an opportunity to talk to you and not only just talk about your background, but then talk a little current NBA as well. So again, thank you very much. Let people know how they can follow you. Just share again, social media and tell them where they can get your book and where they can subscribe to True Hoop and just give me the sales pitch and then I'll jump back in and wrap things up.
Yeah, real quick. So on Twitter, I'm at Coach Thorpe, one word, COACH Thorpe, and I mostly just tweet NBA stuff. I don't tweet a lot of it, but I'll get more involved come postseason two. I do Facebook, which is like a love letter to my children when I'm long dead. They can always check back and see what their dad was doing and thinking their life. David B. Thorpe on Facebook. And Instagram is Coach David Thorpe. I wouldn't recommend doing that. I don't use it for anything of purpose. But truehoop.com is where they can subscribe. We are deeply analytical, an MBA site. I do all the on-court stuff. My partner right now is mostly focused on the billionaires who run our league and some of the dangerous things that we're involved in because we're trying to protect our league. But I do try to provide really good analysis, and then we do two podcasts a week called Bring It In. But it all goes through my Twitter account. So they subscribe it. If they follow me at Coach Thorpe on Twitter, then they'll kind of see where I'm at everywhere.
Perfect. And once again, David, cannot thank you enough for jumping on with us. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening. And we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast presented by Head Start Basketball.